Let's empower the clinicians, the people who see patients day to day. They may not know anything about AI, but let's not start with the researchers. Let's have the end users who are struggling, desperate for solutions every day. Let's let them come up with the ideas and tell us.
Welcome to the AI Sweden podcast with me, Peter Kurtzvelli. In this episode, we will dive deep into the transformative world of healthcare technology. And today we're exploring the frontiers of healthcare where algorithms and analytics are not just tools, but partners in crime changing how we deliver care. In this episode, we're honored to have a very special guest with us from Canada, Dr. Mohamed Mamdani, the Vice President of Data Science and Advanced Analytics at Unity Health Toronto. Dr. Mamdani is at the forefront of integrating artificial intelligence into clinical practice, making Unity Health one of the first hospitals in Canada with a dedicated applied AI team. With him is also his colleague, Michael Page, and Michael is currently the Director of AI Commercialization at Unity Health Toronto, where he leads AI commercialization with the goal to improve patient outcomes and the healthcare system's efficiency. So the team at Unity has, since 2017, been pioneering innovative solutions, launching over 50 applications into production in a healthcare setting, and has witnessed firsthand the powerful impact that AI can have in a hospital setting and on operations and patient care. So in this episode, we're thrilled to be able to discuss how Unity Health is harnessing this technology. We're going to talk about why AI is one of the strategic pillars at Unity Health. We're going to talk about how they're using AI to free up time for healthcare workers, the importance of engaging end user, and how one project has contributed to a greater than 20% reduction in mortality. So with that said, Mohamed and Michael, welcome back to the AI Sweden podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be
awesome.
Here.
So for the listeners that, to inform the listeners why it's a welcome back, it's actually because this is the second time we're recording this. First time we're on site in Toronto, and now we're doing it again because there was so much more we wanted to find out. So we needed to do a longer episode and to really get everything in there, because we think that what you guys are doing at Unity Health is so, so interesting, not only for what's happening in Canada and for what's happening in Sweden, but also can work as an inspiration for AI in medicine and AI, especially in healthcare worldwide, globally. So really, really happy to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Mohamed, you're a clinician at Unity Health. You're a doctor. You're working at a sort of like a hospital network called Unity Health, and that is really what we're going to talk about today. And Michael, you have a really, really interesting role at Unity Health where you're responsible for looking at scaling solutions, really implementing solutions in a clinical setting. And we know you from before since the Vector Institute. But let's start here. So, Dr. Mamdani, you're the main clinician and sort of the main role at Unity. What's your background? How did you end up here?
Yeah, so actually, I'm not a physician by training. I'm a pharmacist by training. So I've got something called a PharmD, a doctor pharmacy degree. And I don't do much clinical work anymore. I used to do clinical practice for about almost 10 years. And what I often struggled with as a clinician are the kind of big three things that clinicians typically do. And some would say there's four, but the big three are going to be around diagnosis, prognosis, and treatment. And the fourth that people also tack on is communicate. What I often struggled with is that healthcare is very, very data-driven. We talk about evidence-based medicine. And evidence is all about having information and data at your fingertips. And if we think about the process of how we make a diagnosis, some diagnoses are very clear-cut. Other diagnoses are much more complicated. when we think about how we manage a patient, we think about, okay, do I think this patient is going to do poorly, or do I think they're going to do okay? Because that will alter how I manage the patient. But we often struggle with how good we are at diagnosis, how good we are at prognosis. And there's many studies to suggest that we're actually not very good at either for many conditions. So for example, the misdiagnosis of schizophrenia is extremely common. The misdiagnosis of depression is extremely common. The misdiagnosis of other conditions that are not mental health for asthma is actually quite common. And what do I mean by common? If we take a look at asthma, there's a study out of Ottawa with over 600 patients that were diagnosed with asthma, over 80% being treated for asthma. And when they brought the patients back in and said, you know, we're going to do proper spirometry, lung function tests, we're actually going to see if you have asthma. About a third of patients did not have asthma, right? When we take a look at schizophrenia, there are studies that suggest that over half of patients who are labeled as being as having schizophrenia actually don't have schizophrenia. So there's quite a bit of a challenge in diagnosis. Now, prognosis, there's numerous studies about how poor we are as clinicians in terms of understanding the course of the outcomes of a patient. And why is that? I think it's because we process a lot of data. Many would say that the average complex medical decision involves considering hundreds of parameters. I think there's something out there that says about 1,000 parameters. Because when we look at a patient, all sorts of things have to be considered. Family history, social history, their vital signs, things like blood pressure and pulse, their lab values, their medical imaging results, all of that has to be considered. And if you're looking at hundreds of parameters that you have to process, when Miller, a famous psychologist from the 1950s, was able to show us that the average human can process 7 plus or minus 2 things at the same time, it becomes problematic. And so the result is that the best studies that we have suggest that 25 to 40% of patients get treatments of unproven effectiveness or even potentially harmful. So there's a lot that we can do in healthcare to improve. And if it is so data-driven, why are we not using data-driven methods, methods like machine learning, AI, that focus on data and complex relationships within those data to help us make better decisions to care for our patients?
We're going to go into why is that? Because that is really such a great question. And that is one of the reasons why where AI Sweden have this project, information-driven healthcare, more on the data-driven healthcare side. So looking at your role right now, what is your role at Unity?
Yeah, so I wear a couple of hats. And maybe I'll talk a little bit about my background first, because some may wonder, why is this clinical pharmacist into AI? And I think my journey has been that I actually went and did a Master of Arts degree in econometric theory of all things, which is really focused on mathematics and economics. And for 2 years, heavy focus is on writing mathematical proofs. And so I always loved math. But then I went on to Harvard to do another master's degree in statistics and epidemiology, very quantitative, really trying to understand how we use data and how we actually are able to leverage it to make better decisions. So that's led to an evolution in my career where I'm an academic. I've done quite a bit of research. I also, again, practiced for a while clinically. I was never really satisfied with the current state because currently, for example, we use randomized clinical trials to guide decision-making. And in many cases, it's fantastic. The problem that I've had with randomized trials is that they tend to exclude a lot of patients. So there's a lot of inclusion-exclusion criteria in randomized trials. So for example, to be eligible for this randomized trial, you must not have A, B, or C, and you have to have X, Y, or Z. Now, the reality is that if I take a look at a patient population that I'm supposed to be managing, 80 to 90% of those patients would be excluded from a typical randomized trial. 80 to 90%. And yet the reporting is on this 10 to 20%, and I'm supposed to generalize it to the rest. That's really hard and not very satisfying. So this is where, again, how can we actually think of data-driven approaches that are personalized for that patient? Because not everyone is the average. In fact, very few are the average. how do we actually tailor that information, that data, to that patient that I'm seeing right now in front of me? And so that's led to the evolution of what I lead now is a data science program. And my current role at Unity Health Toronto is Vice President of Data Science and Advanced Analytics at Unity Health Toronto, where we have a team of about 30 data scientists where we develop and deploy AI solutions into clinical practice. We've deployed over 50 solutions so far. We've seen considerable benefits. We've had some failures, of course. I would say if I had to put numbers to it, 70% succeed, 30% fail, but we learn from those. My other hat is at the University of Toronto, where I'm the director of the Temerty Center for Artificial Intelligence Research and Education in Medicine, which is now a network of 25 universities and over 90 organizations across Canada with over 1,200 members, where we focus on research, education, and infrastructure building in AI and medicine. So again, I have an academic. I'm also a professor in medicine, pharmacy, and public health at the University of Toronto. So it is this nice blend of academic, but also very applied on the clinical side.
And the applied side is really the thing that we're going to go deeper into in this episode. And Michael, turning to you here, because we've known each other for now a couple of years, actually since I arrived in Canada, where you spent your previous professional life at Vector Institute, at one of the three AI institutes in the Pan-Canadian AI strategy. But now you're at Unity Health. How did you end up there? Like, why is this so important for you working in healthcare?
Yeah. It's such a good question. And, you know, let's start off actually, Peter, thank you for your commitment to Canada and promoting all the work that we're doing here and making linkages between us and Europe and Sweden and connecting these ecosystems. So how I found myself at Unity Health is I'm going to do a call back to Muhammad. Is Muhammad and Unity Health are the exception to the rule. So I spent 2 years at one of the national AI institutes at Vector, and a lot of people are talking about machine learning. And like everybody's talking about machine learning, but the reality is, it's just like high school, very few people are doing it. And Muhammad and team, since, you know, 2017, 2018, were doing the exact opposite. They were really doing applied AI work in a clinical setting. So the most regulated, often, you know, people would think the most high risk environment, but with a dedicated and sensitive focus to, we just want to help patients. So that's the reason why I sort of found myself being really drawn to the work and drawn to this opportunity. I spent some time at Vector, really great place and a lovely collection of researchers. I spent a decade in partnerships and advancement at the University of Toronto. I did an MBA along the way. And while I was doing my MBA, I really focused on and was fascinated with, you know, creative destruction and the idea of diffusion of technology. And Muhammad and team have found a way to do that. And I think, you know, when I was talking to him about coming here, that's really the mandate of the job. Is our hospital network is three locations, but how can we expand? How can we scale? How can we go from three hospitals to 30? How can we go from 30 to 300? And we're going to do that in a wide variety of ways, but having that mandate, having that mission and that opportunity is just a dream of a lifetime.
And I think that the core thing that what we feel and what we see looking at what you guys are doing, that it's really about that, like just wanting to help patients and just wanting to help the healthcare system, the clinicians, help them be able to give better care. But if we go into that, if we try to understand, because Unity Health is probably new to most of our listeners, and if we want to understand Unity Health better, can you just explain Unity Health? What is Unity Health?
Unity Health is a composition of three centers in Toronto. The first is St. Michael's Hospital, which is an academic teaching hospital, level one trauma center, right in downtown Toronto. We serve the inner city largely, but of course we are a center that gets trauma cases because we've been designated as such. The second hospital, St. Joseph's Hospital, which is in the West End, and that is a community hospital, which has quite a bit of volume. The third institution is Providence Health, which is a long-term care rehab facility. And that's on the East End. So really crossing a spectrum from the community to academic to long-term care and rehab. And we've had a history of data at these institutions. So for example, at St. Michael's, because of its academic mission, because of the foresight of the leadership, we've amassed about 15 years of historical data. And that's quite a bit of data to work with to actually develop a lot of these solutions. And I think the culture is actually quite interesting as well. We tend to have a roll up the sleeves and get the job done type of culture at Unity Health, which is again, really, really refreshing, but also challenging the norm where we want to provide the best possible care for this patient population that just is in such dire need, where we really want to do as much as we can for them. So it's interesting because we have 8 strategic pillars. 3 of them are core strategic pillars. And AI is one of those core core strategic pillars. And that's fairly unique because we're the only hospital in Canada that has actually declared AI as a core strategic pillar. And I don't know of any other hospital in the world. There may be, but certainly in Canada, we're the only hospital to say that AI is a very, very important strategic priority for us, which means from the top down, AI is infused into our institution.
We're going to post together with this episode, we're going to post one of the pictures that me and my colleague Johanna was so inspired by, but also we said like, just wow, the way you involve clinicians and also patients into the journey of applying AI, because it was all over the elevators. It was like you're creating this narrative what AI can do for healthcare, so that you're opening up your organization to collaborate with the rest of the hospital settings, with the rest of the clinicians. So but why is that? Like why is AI going to make such a big difference in healthcare? Why is it chosen as one of the core strategic pillars?
Yeah, I think from my perspective, you know, when we look at how we care for our patients, so much of it is data driven, right? And we have so much data to work with. And I know there's this history of, well, let's look at the lab value without really understanding what happened 2 days ago. And of course, we try, right? But our memories are typically not often that good. Our ability to cite incredibly complex patterns in data is just not very good because the human mind has challenges with that. We have some incredible clinicians, world-leading clinicians, in fact, especially when we look at critical care, our trauma physicians, just many of them are just fantastic. But even they struggle, despite years and years of intensive training and experience, really understanding those finer complexities in data. And so this is where we feel techniques like machine learning, like AI, that are made to untangle these complex relationships can really help us provide better care. So when we're sitting there struggling, thinking, I don't really know if this patient is going to die in the next 48 hours. So I don't know if I should be very aggressive or if it's okay just to wait and watch. That's where AI, I think, can give us insights to say, actually, you know, they may not do well in the next 48 hours. And you should be a bit more aggressive in how you manage that patient. Just a recommendation. Maybe you should look into it.
I think that's such an important insight, Mohammed, and maybe one that we haven't fully even realized yet of what that's changed for medicine or what that has changed for clinical practice. And I'd say, you know, not a clinician, but being a patient, your experience is very reactionary, right? Like, I've hurt my arm, or I've got this pain in my leg or in my chest. But a lot of the tools our team has built, and ChartWatch, a good example of, is that it's allowing proactive treatment, right? Like they're inpatient, they're in the hospital, but it's allowing clinicians, or it's notifying clinicians so that we can do something proactive rather than, you know, deterioration sort of setting in or transfer to ICU setting in. So that's been a really fun way. Like I don't want to say like the data science is interesting, but the intervention piece is really fascinating to think about and how that's impacting clinical care.
And the project, or the project that you're talking about there, ShartWatch, is something that we will dive deeper into here, because that is a very, very interesting project that is actually saving real human lives in an operational setting, which is and really, really amazing when you're thinking about, yeah, we just want to do it better for the patients, and what could be a better outcome than actually saving lives. But if we're looking at how you're approaching this topic, then, because we know that there's everyone working in machine learning or AI knows how hard it is to develop the models, but the really hard thing is putting them into production and into an operational setting. So what's the structure of the AI team at Unity Health? How do you approach this?
Yeah, we have 4 core teams, and we thought through what are the mechanics to get things deployed. Because when we looked around to our colleagues who are doing some incredible work in AI and medicine research, we quickly realized that the model that people typically have is first you start with the researchers. The researchers drive the questions. They are very inquisitive, very bright, very motivated to find answers to things that very few people think about and sometimes solve common problems. What they typically do is they say, here's a question. I'm going to cut some data. I'm going to put this data in an environment where then I can analyze and do sophisticated analyses and gain some insights. That tends to be challenging, but relatively easy compared to a different type of model where we said, well, wait a minute. Are the researchers the one who are actually providing care? And in some cases, they are, because we have clinician scientists, but in many cases, they're not. So we struggled with how can you possibly understand really the day-to-day issues, the day-to-day mechanics, the day-to-day management, if you're not practicing, if you're not on the ground seeing patients every day? Do you have the discipline then to step back and say, what are the outcomes that I'm really trying to tackle? Because in the research model, it doesn't have to be about outcomes per se. It has to be about inquiry. Inquiry is very important. Whereas in our model, we really more focus on outcomes. Inquiry is, of course, terrific, but we have a very, very strict focus on outcome. And so we needed a different model. So the model that we took was, okay, well, first of all, let's empower the clinicians, the end users, the people who see patients day to day. They may not know anything about AI, but let's not start with the researchers. Let's not have our data scientists come up with questions. Let's have the end users who are struggling, desperate for solutions every day. Let's let them come up with the ideas and tell us why they're so desperate for solutions. Let's use those ideas to then drive solutions and structure our teams. So let's say we start with the poor end user who's saying, I'm really struggling with assigning my nurses to the different zones in the emergency department, or I have no idea when this patient is going to crash, and I know they're going to die at some point. I just don't know when, and I don't know how to help them. Or my staff is really burnt out, and I don't know what to do, but I know that if I could change X or Y, it might make a difference. How can we tackle those sorts of problems? Well, if it's data-driven, first we need to get the data. So our first team is the data integration and governance team. We call it the DIG team. They're really focused on data engineering, modeling architecture, ETL, extract, transform, load, types of processes that kind of scrub and clean the data a little bit. So they are responsible for getting the data that we need for a particular problem. So you can imagine they're responsible for saying, okay, well, your reaction time is going to be in seconds, not minutes or hours. So we need to actually get these data that are being produced in real time to a centralized place. Well, all right, you've got it into a centralized place. You were able to manage to get all the data you need within less than a second. Now what do? You got to clean it a little bit. So they go through that process as well with their data engineering efforts. Well, now what do? It's got to go through a machine learning model. Our second team, the advanced analytics team, builds those models. So while the first team focuses on the data engineering and the data gathering and a little bit of cleaning, the second team says, I'm going to build the neural networks. Or maybe it's a convolutional neural network, or maybe it's an optimization model. They're really the experts, or it's a vision learning model, whatever have you. they're the ones who actually will build the model. Now, when you actually come out with the model, and this is what you need to build in real time, again, it has to go through a machine learning model in real time, it spits out output. Most clinicians will not understand that output. So how do you actually build a solution that is easy to understand, that respects clinicians' workflows, that humans want to interact with? And that is our third team, is the product development team. Now, the product development team is headed up by an artist. And he's a musician, but he had a very key interest in AI, and he's done a Master of Science in Applied Computing. But his interest was not in developing the algorithms, it was in developing solutions that focus on human-AI interaction. So really focusing on things like design, human factors, software development, where they create solutions that humans want to interact with. Okay, so you've created a solution. And you've been able to do this all in real time. And the core here, again, is a machine learning operations environment rather than a research environment. They're very different. A machine learning operations environment, I would argue, is far more difficult to create than a research environment. But they use that as their infrastructure. So the third team's created the solution. Now, how do you deploy? Because to deploy, you need to be able to go on the floors, really understand the workflows, go into change management practices, follow up, evaluate, really interact with the clinicians, be part of their team. That's our product management and deployment team. So that's the fourth team, product management and deployment. They focus on getting the solution into practice, and they're experts in, of course, project management with timelines, milestones, and deliverables. They're also experts in education and change management, and they're the ones who actually execute. And of course, it also goes back to all of our teams to evaluate and to maintain those solutions. And in fact, we have our data scientists on call 24/7 because we don't want to create a solution just for the now and walk away. That would be a research framework where we publish a paper and you're done. These solutions are going to be used for years to come. What happens if data pipelines fail? What happens if the model degrades or your data structure changes? If these systems are critical, and right now we have algorithms that run every 15 seconds and they're critical to hospital operations, if they fail, who fixes it? We're building an environment now that will read data 100 times a second from monitors and ventilators. In the ICU, in the trauma bay, these are absolutely critical patients. If they fail, people will die. So who's going to fix those? So our data scientists take call. And if anything happens, they're responsible, and they'll be able to fix it in real time. Now, those are the four teams, and they work within that MLOps environment.
And this is quite unique, the way you've structured the team. We've read over and over again about challenges in healthcare, about when the challenges in deploying models, maintaining models, looking at governance. And what's really special, and this goes back to what you said earlier, Michael, is about the focus on doing and the focus on putting things in production, that the value that is created is really in a production or in an environment that is operational. And what I find really interesting is also the way that you've been thinking about maintenance. So you've actually have maintenance operator, you have 24/7 on call data scientists looking at what needs to be fixed. And that you're involving end users in the beginning and at the, like, in the entire process, so that you're actually deploying and developing tools that they will use, because if they're not using them, they won't create any value. So I find this so fascinating. But still, there's a bunch of barriers. What's the barriers of adoption for you? Where do you identify the barriers? What problems keep on occurring when you're looking at this process?
I think maybe I'll add, and then I'll jump over to Michael and kind of get it more into his absolutely critical role as well. I would say the barriers are several fold. The first is getting the problem right. Oftentimes in healthcare, we tackle the wrong questions, and we tackle the wrong target audiences. So what do I mean by that? For an example is we've worked on a couple of projects now where the specialists come in and they say, well, here's the issue we're struggling with. And this is the model we think we need to build. And we quickly realized the specialists are the ones raising the issue because what somebody else is doing is affecting them. So they're not really the target audience. The other group of clinicians is the target audience. And so essentially, we're creating a solution for a group that isn't really the end user, which doesn't make any sense. So it's really navigating around what's the right clinical question? Who's the right target audience? Really getting that really structured well first and foremost. Second is inclusion. And what do I mean by that? There are going to be people in a group who will say, we really, really want to do this. And there'll be others who will say, absolutely not. I will never do this. How do you actually get at the lowest common denominator of resistance? Is you target them and you include them. And if you're in a position where there's so much adversity, maybe it's not a good idea to tackle that problem. So really understanding and having your ear to the ground, being engaged and understanding the dynamics of your end users to really understand what will work and what will not work, I think is 80% of the problem solved. You know, there's a saying by Einstein that if he had an hour to solve a problem, he would spend 55 minutes understanding the problem and 5 minutes developing the solution. So I think it's fundamental to really understand the nature of the problem first and foremost. I would say the second problem is making sure that you have the right quantity and quality of data to build the model in an effective manner. And sometimes we tackle problems where the condition's so rare, you just don't have enough data to tackle it, well. Sometimes we have problems that we have a lot of data, but the quality is just really awful. And so those are problems that we probably shouldn't tackle either until we fix those issues. I would say the third problem is around adoption. And it's related to the first, where it's about inclusion, it's about understanding who the key players are. But it's also about understanding workflows. The last thing you want is to create a solution that makes work rather than lessens it. We have incredibly busy clinicians. Yes, healthcare workers are burnt out. If you add more on their plate, more to do, you're only asking for trouble. So how do you make their lives easier and not harder? That can be often tough to do because these AI solutions have to integrate rather than add to workload. And I think the fourth problem is, how do you scale? And this is something where we failed in the past. We have not done well. We've tried, and it hasn't worked out well. We would like our solutions to be in as many hospitals as possible, but different hospitals have different workflows, have different cultures, have different all sorts of things. So how do you scale? I think other groups can do this much better than we can. And we completely lacked expertise in this area. We lacked the understanding of how you actually then bring it to other hospitals. And a critical hire for us was Michael Page, where we were very fortunate to be able to recruit him from the Vector Institute with a huge focus on, okay, how do we actually engage, for example, private sector who can have a really focused, disciplined approach to scaling, productizing and scaling these solutions outside of our four walls. And Michael, fortunately, has been able to bring in many more insights than just on the scaling side. He's really been able to integrate with the team, work with our clinicians, and really understand the issues. So we have a practical approach of developing solutions that can then scale and spread.
Yes. Well, thanks, Mohammed. I mean, I'll layer onto that. A barrier or maybe like scale is a solution to funding. And funding is a massive barrier. I think whether you're for profit, if you're in a hospital, or you're working in a factory right now, who pays for the AI thing is very questionable. So we're trying to productize. We're also looking at how do we open source? How do we maintain and continue partnerships like we have with AI Sweden? That will help offset some of the things that the expenses we're incurring. But the scale piece, the commercialization piece, the productization piece is about reaching more patients. And we're going to try a lot of things. And I'd say, having the agency to be able to fail and make mistakes and learn as we go and keep building the plane as we fly it is a really privileged place. And something you don't see other places. We know this from talking to other hospitals and other organizations. It's not something that you typically see at an organization. So Unity Health has top down the right culture. We've really gone all in on AI. So we talked about, you know, our four different teams and sort of our data science and advanced analytics group, but AI being a core strategic pillar, this is on the board's agenda. The board's talking about, you know, AI on a monthly basis and thinking about where's the next implementation. We're supported by two charitable foundations, so the St. Michael's Hospital Foundation and the St. Joseph's Health Center Foundation, who've helped fund some of our work. So philanthropically offsetting our budget as well. But I'd say like the other piece, and where we talk to hospitals, we talk to clinicians, a big barrier are sometimes the internal mechanics. So is AI ethical? Is this a privacy breach, or, you know, should we or can we access patient data? What's legal and what's not legal? And, you know, the AI Act in the European Union was just passed last week. You know, I'm sure all of our colleagues in Sweden are scratching their heads about what's an AI critical system now this week that wasn't last week. And how do we overcome that barrier? So a place of privilege, but a real benefit of Unity Health going all in on AI is some of my best friends in the organization is our general counsel and our head of privacy and our head of IT security, who literally take my phone call at any point in the day and are all in on this strategic vision. And when I say that, it's also this willingness, ability to be novel in your pursuit to build something. There is no playbook. You are going to be the black sheep, and you have to be comfortable building something that no one else has built before. So we have an incredible team of, you know, 30 data scientists, product managers, and data engineers, but we have an even greater organization from the board down that believe in this vision and are delivering on it daily.
And speaking, like, from my perspective, speaking to so many practitioners in the field of AI, this is such a core thing. Having a strategic vision, really explaining, creating a narrative of what you're moving towards and why you're investing this much into this space, so that you create inclusion, engagement, and involvement of the entire organization. And I think that is something that you have been doing really, really well in terms of how you're spreading that internal communication. And I'm looking forward to seeing the effects of this, like, external communication that you're starting with right now, because that is really something that will hopefully scale up solutions. So looking at more on the like tangible side, the project sides, because that can also help our listeners understand more. Let's start with the ShartWatch, because that is a public project. It's you've been talking about it openly. Mohammed, if you go into what is ShartWatch?
ShartWatch is basically, it's an early warning system. Basically, what the issue is, let me actually start by the model then. Our internist came to us and said, one of the key issues they're struggling with is how to identify patients who will deteriorate. Because the reality is that the average internist will probably spend maybe 5, if I'm being generous, 10 minutes per patient per day. That's really it, right? Because they have so many other demands on their time. It's very limited in terms of how much time they'll actually spend talking to a patient. And many of these patients can't talk. They're not in a position to. And so spending time reviewing their notes, reviewing their labs, their vitals, their medical imaging results, it's not as much time as they would like, but it's the best that we can do. Nurses, they're there, absolutely, but they're incredibly busy as well. So our internists came to us and they said, well, when we actually take a look at the patients who die, we realize that there's quite a few patients who, no matter what we do, they will die regardless. It's really unfortunate, but that's what will happen. But there's also quite a few patients who maybe we could have helped if we had more time, if we had known earlier, but we just didn't know that they were going to deteriorate. And of course, the question is, well, what could you have done? And the response was, well, we could have actually watched them more carefully and jumped on any issues earlier. We could have called the critical care response team to get them to the ICU where they can get more intensive management. We could have done that earlier. We could have looked for signs of sepsis, thought about initiating antibiotics to get on top of the infection earlier before it just becomes so terrible that it will be fatal. So there's many things that we could do. But we need time. We need an early warning to be able to get our resources together and manage that patient more effectively and appropriately. So the ask was, can we have an AI algorithm that monitors our patients regularly and alerts us in advance to patients who will die? And when we asked them, well, how much earlier would you need? And they said, ideally 48 hours in advance. So if the algorithm can predict who will die or go to the ICU 48 hours in advance, that would be really helpful. So ChartWatch is an algorithm, and it's been trained on over 20,000 patients worth of data. It's learned all sorts of permutations and combinations. And the way ChartWatch works at our institution is it runs every hour on the hour. So it runs hourly. It's all automated. You don't have to enter any data. It just pulls whatever is existing. And it predicts in the next 48 hours if a patient is going to die or go to the ICU. It categorizes patients as low, medium, and high risk. As soon as it reaches a high risk threshold, it's automated to page the medical team. Our protocol is the medical team has to come and see the patient within 2 hours of being paged. And again, there's all sorts of care pathways that are outlined. Do you increase monitoring to every 4 hours? Do you look for signs of sepsis, initiate antibiotics and such? We deployed the algorithm in October of 2020. So we have a little over 3 years of experience. And we just submitted a paper for publication now after doing an analysis. We're seeing a greater than 20% reduction in mortality, which again, we're very excited about. I think one of the biggest things though is asking our clinicians, do you actually use this? And overwhelmingly from our clinical teams, it's a critical part of how they practice now. So now this is just how we do business. ChartWatch, our clinicians, many of them will look at it at the beginning of their time, and it'll help them understand which patients to prioritize. Who do they round on first? Do they spend a little bit more time on? Our nurses, we didn't really intend this use, but the way they use it is they also say, all right, well, before what was happening is some of the nurses would get all the hard patients, other nurses wouldn't, and then there would be some stress and inequality there. Now our rule is that a nurse will have no more than 2 high-risk patients. And so the high-risk patients are now more equitably distributed. So you can have more fair allocation, but also the nurses can spend more time with the patients who need because they're not all chasing, or that one nurse is not chasing all the hard patients. It's more equitably distributed, and that's just better care for our patients.
And what has been key in driving the engagement of the nurses there? Because they are really the end users. How did you engage them in this project from the beginning?
Well, I'll be very frank. I think we made a mistake in the beginning because we really focused on the clinicians. On the physicians first. And we did a little bit of nurse engagement, but not a lot. And I think that was a mistake that we made. So the physicians, while they were excited, when we were first deploying it, many of the nurses were a bit taken by surprise. And there was some resistance, actually. So some of the nurses were saying, I don't think I want to use this. But I would say within the first week or two, they quickly adapted and realized, wow, we could actually use this in our favor to allocate patients more effectively and equitably. And they became actually even bigger champions after a couple of weeks of use. So we were very fortunate, but it was an oversight at our end to not engage them as well as we should have. And so that's actually affected our engagement model because this was several years ago that we had deployed this project. And now we're a lot more cognizant of making sure that we get all the end users, not just the physicians, not just the nurses, but the entire team engaged rather than just focusing on one or maybe even two segments.
And looking from a scaling perspective here, Michael, and looking at the adoption in other hospitals, what do you do to drive this, like identifying champions, identifying and driving engagement?
I think the first thing that we have to do is really see if there's, number one, interest and desire, right? Mm-hmm. The clinicians have to want to do this. And if clinicians are just, no matter how much you rationalize with them, they just don't want it, it's not going to work. There has to be engagement. So I would say if clinicians are not understanding it, they're not excited about it, they don't want it, I would not waste time, energy, and resources trying to do this. I would spend time educating. I would spend time trying to see if their interest could be built. And if it can't, I would move on to a different problem. The next part is, how do we actually get data and retrain the algorithm just to make sure that it works on their data, understand their workflows? Because, for example, at St. Michael's Hospital, it's an academic hospital. We have residents, we have academics, clinician scientists, we have clinicians all over the place. It's very much a physician-driven model. But in a community hospital, it's often a nurse-driven model, which is a whole other ballgame. So making sure that we adapt to different workflows and different organizations becomes important. And of course, the rollout and the discipline to actually monitor and evaluate becomes really critical. Just because we have incredible benefits at St. Michael's doesn't mean another hospital will see the same benefits if this isn't done carefully and thoughtfully. And this is where, again, it takes so much time and energy and resource for our team to go to another hospital, and we're not funded to do that, where we thought there has to be another group that shares our approach, that shares our values, and wants to deploy these solutions in a responsible and ethical manner to see the benefits that we're seeing. And this is where, again, Michael has been leading efforts on how do we actually then scale.
Yeah. So in this particular case with ChartWatch and a few other tools, we had the amazing opportunity to establish a high growth startup called Signal One. And they're based here in Toronto. And a lot of people in the Toronto ecosystem or Canadian AI ecosystem will know CEO Tommy Putinen, who previously founded Layer 6 and was TD Bank's chief AI officer. Heard about the work we were doing. His partner is a physician, and knew of Mohammed and the team's work, and presented with the opportunity, really took on establishing this company with a really incredible founding team. So we're grateful that they're running with some of the things that we built to get them into more and more hospitals. And something else that we have with this is a multi-year collaboration with them to co-develop solutions and test solutions with them. So that's one of the things that we're doing. The other piece is, I don't know how many more, startups we will do. We always take the meeting, see if there's something there. But the reality is, in healthcare, these are very entrenched markets for the large medical device companies. They're global, multinational, billion and trillion dollar companies. So we're now at a point of maturity where we want to think about, traditional tech transfer. How do we build things that can be, a new feature or a new product line or a new line of business for some of these companies? But also, how can we develop a co-creation model with them? How can we work with these companies so they can learn from us, quite frankly, of building and deploying AI in real time is a significant challenge. And we seem to have solved that. We have a number of solutions that are saving lives on an annual basis. So we'll tease out both of those of, still supporting the startups that we've been active with, but look at some more traditional channels as well.
And if we look at more projects that you've been doing, because one thing that I personally find really interesting is that you've been, while you're having such a huge focus on AI as a strategic pillar, one thing that you really have done, and this comes back to what you said earlier, Mohammed, is that like, okay, what are we using the technology for? What are the problems and that we're trying to solve? And one thing that you've been focusing on is research planning and optimization of the organization. Because if we look at machine learning is very much like an optimization and technology. So you've also been focusing on how do we help and free up time for nurses, for clinicians, for physicians. So if we look at one of the projects that you've been having in sort of like planning of like operations, scheduling and schema logging, can we go deeper into that?
Yeah, absolutely. So on the productivity end, and we're getting more and more interest from other groups now, but we built our nurses from the emergency department. I'm going to use that as a case example of one of the productivity solutions. Our nurses in the emergency department came to us and said, one of our biggest problems and our biggest stressors is assigning nurses to the different zones in the emergency department. And the way our process typically works is that when end users come to us with a problem, we want them to quantify the magnitude of the problem. So of course we asked, well, how big of an issue is this? Because if you're spending 2 minutes a day on this, it's probably not a big enough issue to tackle. So tell me how much time you're spending. And they said, well, there's all sorts of rules we have to adhere to. So a junior nurse has to be with the senior nurse, has to be with the team lead. You can't have the same work nurse working in the same zone with the same person over the past 48-hour period. And every time we violate those rules, ideally, we really have to do the whole thing again. And we do it on Excel and paper. And I said, okay, but how much time are you spending? And they said, well, our team lead, which is a senior nurse, spends 90 minutes a day roughly on this task. Our clerks spend about 2 hours a day on this task. So that's between 3 to 4 hours a day that people are spending on this task that really should not be taking their time. And so, of course, we developed a solution by asking them, what are these rules that you have to adhere to? And they said, oh, but there's one more thing. Before we get into the rules, there's this stress factor of if we don't assign certain nurses, they advocate for working with their friends. They think we're biased. They think we just don't like them. And then they raise all sorts of issues for us. And they think they have personal vendettas. So that's very stressful for us. So there's the mechanic side, then there's the social side. And we really just would love to have something that we can blame and say it's not us making the decision. It's this unbiased thing that doesn't care about feelings or care about, it just cares about what's fair and what the rules are. So we built an optimization algorithm that quote unquote watches all of our nurses. So it knows who worked where, when, with whom. And it's a fairly sophisticated optimization algorithm that's embedded into a software solution, where in the software solution, it knows who all the nurses are. It keeps a track of who's worked where, when, with whom. And you click a button, it'll do your assignments for the next 4 days. If somebody comes up, complains and says, but I really, really need to work this because my child has a birthday on X and I can't do that shift. You can just say exception, click the button, and it'll do the assignments again. So we also asked, well, currently, how bad are you in terms of making errors? And they said, we violate the rules all the time. So we're guessing over 20% of the time we make errors. We violate the rules. So having these rules in place, having an optimization algorithm that is impartial, we deployed it. And the impacts have been that our team leads now report that they went from 90 minutes a day to under 1 minute on this task. Our clerks went from 2 hours every day to under 15 minutes. And the error rate or repeat rate has went from 21% to under 5%. Just saving time, reducing inefficiencies, and being impartial. And now the biggest benefit that they say is the time is great. But now we don't have to keep justifying ourselves and our decisions. We just say the robot, I think that's what they call it, the robot did it. And people accept it because they can't emotionally argue with a robot.
And you're freeing up the social tension in an organization.
Yes.
And absolutely. Looking at projects like this, you think about this as from multiple angles, but you can think about like applying this in all types of different organizations too, where you want to avoid like a social tension or a friction in terms of making decisions.
Absolutely. And it's also about remembering things, right? Because one of the other things that they'd complain about is when somebody comes up to them and said, well, you know, I haven't worked with this person in a while. Well, before it was scrounging through paper and Excel spreadsheets and hopefully finding something you save. But now it's a very easy function on this software where you can say, actually, let's look back 2 weeks. You actually did work with this person on the same day. So it holds people accountable and it's very easy to be able to justify decisions.
This is such a no-brainer. It sounds like it's such a given that this should be, this is the perfect case for machine learning.
Yeah, we think so. The main point that I really wanted to make here is that in healthcare, we are overstretched. We are putting a lot of pressure on our staff, on our team members, and they're burnt out. And what we keep hearing is do more with less, do more with less. And many of our healthcare providers are saying, I've already done more. I've done as much as I can. I can't do any more. And yet you're still telling me to do more with less. It's at that point where you make a decision to say, do we keep pressing? Do we keep trying to squeeze blood out of a rock? Or do we have completely different ways of doing business? Completely innovative ways of thinking that we're not asking people anymore to do more work, but we're helping them to relieve some of their work. And I think that's where AI comes in, is on the second part, is really to be their partners in making their jobs and lives easier so they can provide better care to the patients we serve.
Because it's all about the patient and doing it in a sustainable way that gives care in a sustainable way.
Absolutely. As soon as we lose sight of the core objective, and this is we say this to all of our team members and all of our projects. This is not about your, it's not about you. It's not about your ego. It's about the patients we serve. As soon as you lose sight of that, you've lost.
I don't even think we can end this on a better note than that. That AI will be the very mechanical friend that will help if developed and deployed right, with inclusion, with engagement, with involvement from the operational side of healthcare. It could really be the friend and the tool that the system and the overall operations needs, so that we don't have to just or do more with less resources. We can actually increase quality and do what clinicians want to do. Help patients, care for patients. Mohammed and Michael, thank you so much for spending this hour with me. I am really, really grateful that we get to spread the message of the work that Unity Health is doing. And I'm really, really looking forward to follow the work that you're doing in the future too, because I think that you're really taking a position here. And what we also want to mention is that we've really dug deep into, from an AI Sweden perspective, deep into the different healthcare systems, looking at different providers and different developers in this space. And you guys are definitely on the forefront, not just in Canada, but worldwide, globally. So this is really inspiring work you're doing. And I'm really, really looking forward to what we'll do together in the near future.
Thank you so much, Peter. Michael, I imagine you want to say a few words too, but I want to thank you in AI Sweden. We're trying to do the best we can for the patients we serve, but to get the word out, to communicate, to bring the message to the larger audience, that incredibly important and monumentally difficult challenge, we can't thank you enough for taking that on and making our story known and our voices heard. So thank you, Peter, for everything you do, and for AI Sweden for being so wonderful, thoughtful, and pragmatic. We're just honored and humbled to be able to partner with such an incredible group of people. Thank you.
I want to jump in and say thank you, and that I don't think we can end on a better note than this, of two organizations that are squarely focused on impacting patient care and thinking about how far we can go together. So thank you to Peter, everyone listening. This is going to be a global change, and we're happy to work with anyone that comes knocking on our door.
And more information that you as a listener will need will be in the show notes. So Mohammed and Michael, thank you so much. And we will talk soon again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the AI Sweden podcast. If you want to know more about AI Sweden, you can visit ai.se. This is the AI Sweden podcast. With me, Peter Kurtzvelli. Until next time.